wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
It's about that time when Mr. Gordon Goldsboro is back with Abandoned Manitoba. Gordon, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Now, remind us of the clue from last week.
4 years ago, I visited a remote camp where construction workers for Manitoba Hydro's new kiosk generating station were being accommodated. Its luxurious amenities were a stark contrast to a former construction camp near the Whiteshell Provincial Park. And that contrast is our subject today.
So why were you at the kiosk construction camp?
I was visiting some historic sites along the Nelson River, and one of the people with whom I was traveling worked for Manitoba Hydro, so we stopped at the construction camp for a meal. I was impressed by the modular complex that had basically been designed to be disassembled when the project is completed. Eventually, no sign will remain of what had once been a massive facility used by hundreds of workers that included private bedrooms and bathrooms, dining rooms, a bar that incidentally imposed a strict two-drink limit, a gym, a small theater. You know, clearly these workers were not roughing it to work in this remote location. Quite a different situation from that experienced by workers on earlier hydro mega projects in northern Manitoba.
Such as
the Kelsey Generating Station. It was built between 1957 and 1961, motivated by the discovery of a large nickel ore deposit that ultimately led to the establishment of the city of Thompson. They needed electricity to develop that nickel ore, and so the Manitoba Hydroelectric Board, the predecessor to Manitoba Hydro, agreed to build what was, at that time, the most northerly hydroelectric generating station in all of North America. The Kelsey project ultimately led to changes in labor practices that are illustrated today by that kiosk camp that I visited.
How did labor law affect that project?
Well, workers at Kelsey were paid according to what was called the Fair Wage Act that goes way back to 1916. That act prescribed that because of the site's northern location, workers were paid less than if they worked elsewhere. So, for example, carpenters on the Kelsey project were paid $1.65 per hour, but they could make up to 40% more working in Winnipeg. I mean, that seems almost counterintuitive today. You'd think the further away you would work, the more you would be paid. But no, just the opposite. There was no overtime pay. So workers at Kelsey had to work, well, sometimes 12 hours or more each day, or they could risk being fired. More troubling, perhaps, were the conditions under which the workers had to live.
The conditions, huh? In what way?
Well, there were no flush toilets, for example, only outdoor biffies. A provincial health inspector found the condition of two of those biffies so deplorable that he ordered them burned down. They just couldn't be cleaned. They were so bad.
Wow.
The workers were given a bedroom that had no door. So in order to get any sort of element of privacy, they'd have to hang blankets over the doorway. The ventilation in the summer was poor, so they sweltered in the heat. The heating in the winter was so erratic that, well, they often had to wear extra clothes in bed just to stay warm. The workers were not unionized, so if anyone complained, again, they could be fired. And later projects were just as bad. During construction of the Grand Rapids Generating Station, for instance, between 1960 and 1968, a lot of the workers there lived in tents year-round, winter and summer.
Wow. And so your clue referred to an abandoned construction camp in the Whiteshell.
Right. The camp is along the CN main line near the siding of what's called Hochter. And it's near the western boundary of Whiteshell Provincial Park near Rennie. The railway was constructed around 1907 or 1908, and the remnants of its remote construction camp, well, they're still there today in the form of bake ovens made of large stones. You know, I have a mental picture of construction workers living in canvas tents, cooking their own meals and eating them while they're sitting on rock outcrops of the Canadian Shield.
Wow, wow. And what do we know about the builders of the Hochter ovens?
Well, very little, either here or elsewhere where such ovens have been found. The oldest known railway bake oven in Canada is in Yoho National Park in British Columbia. It was built in 1884 during construction of the Canadian Pacific. Several other stone ovens stand near Naramata, British Columbia, believed to have been built between 1911 and 1915. Now, we know that railway construction crews were ethnically diverse, and the practice of using stones to make a bake oven is fairly widespread around the world. So two of those BC ovens are believed to have been built by Scandinavian or Chinese workers. And that's pretty much all we know about who the builders of these ovens were.
Interesting, interesting. Now I'm curious, what do the Hochter ovens look like?
Well, the one that I found when I visited there was a dome-shaped pile of gray stones about 400 feet north of the CN main line. The pile was roughly 5 feet in diameter and perhaps somewhere around 3 feet high, with a small opening on one side. It sat on top of a rock outcrop, and the individual stones that made up the oven were very angular. My guess is that they were dislodged by explosives when the construction crew was making a level grade for the new railway line, and they saw all these stones lying around and thought, hey, we can make an oven out of these things.
So how do they work?
Well, if they work like bake ovens elsewhere, the idea is that you would build a wood fire inside this dome of stones and allow the fire to burn long enough to heat up the stones. And then when the fire had burned down, you'd reach in and you'd scoop out the coals that were left over, and the hot rocks would radiate heat long enough that you could insert some uncooked bread dough in, and it would bake over a matter of 15 or 20 minutes.
Interesting. And so how many ovens are there?
Well, I found just one of them during my visit to the area, but my friends George Penner and Morgan Turney tell me that there are several others along that main line between Rennie and the Ontario border. What I presume happened is that as the camp would move as construction of the railway progressed, and so each time they'd move the camp where they lived, they would have to build a new bake oven at each site. So it's possible that there's many such ovens throughout this area.
And I wonder, what's the condition of the ovens like?
Well, some of them that I've seen photos of are essentially intact. You know, there's still a nice intact dome. But the one that I found, the roof had collapsed. And you know, to be honest, if anyone found one of these things, I think they would be hard-pressed to know what it had been. And I worry, therefore, that people may not recognize them as important artifacts from over 100 years ago, and they may just disassemble them. And, you know, I think that would be wrong, because these ovens deserve to be preserved.
And why do they deserve to be preserved?
Well, if nothing else, I think the Hochter ovens illustrate the improvement in living conditions for workers who work in these remote areas far from home and family. Because if my visit to the Kias camp taught me anything, it's really how much working conditions for workers have improved in 100 years.
Well, thanks so much for that, Gordon.
You're welcome, Jim.
Now, tell me, what's up for next week?
Well, in this series, we talk about abandoned buildings, we talk about abandoned structures, and whole sorts of other things. Next week, we're going to talk about ghost towns, where an entire town has been abandoned. And we're going to include some examples where the description of ghost town doesn't quite fit, at least not yet.
Great. We'll talk next week.
Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.